Hey guys, welcome to Tales from a Butterfly podcast. I'm your host, Taria Shondell. Sometimes caterpillar, sometimes butterfly, but always striving to make it through life's many metamorphoses with my faith intact. With this podcast, I hope to encourage anyone that is going through life situations, no matter what they are, that have left you feeling like you will forever be a caterpillar in the cocooning stage, having to continually shed your skin while fighting to get free from any chains that are holding you back from your transformation. I want to tell you, keep your faith in the transformer, believing that just like the butterfly, when you come out, you will be a thing of beauty who is not afraid to fly. So come on, my butterflies, let's fly. You're listening to episode 48 of the Tales from a Butterfly podcast, titled Kia Riddick Taylor. From casting to coaching, this star catcher fills us in on what happens when life becomes unscripted. And I'm your host, Taria Shondell. So let's get into it. I am super duper excited to be interviewing the owner of Star Catcher Acting Studio. This phenomenal young lady got her start in TV and film over 20 years ago, which you would never know by looking at her because I've seen her via Skype. So she definitely doesn't look like she's been doing this for over 20 years. But while she was working as a casting director for Nickelodeon, she's now a successful acting coach and has helped many of her students book film and TV projects all over the country. Her students can be seen on TV and in films like the hit Netflix Fuller House, War for Planet of the Apes, Bloodline, Law and Order SUV, and Orange is the New Black, just to name a few. Now, when she's not in the studio, she can be found traveling around the world as an on-set coach. My experience, the way I met this phenomenal woman was my children, as I've mentioned on the podcast before, are in the entertainment industry, and they were going to, I guess, what I would like to call a showcase for a network TV station. And their manager actually sent me her name and her information. And she was in a totally different time zone. I want to say Canada, but she'll correct me when she comes on if I was wrong. And she literally got back to me like, it was like boom, boom, back and forth. And she squeezed not one, but both of the kids in for acting sections, and she was phenomenal. And I believe I told her at the end, I think I want to be an actress too. Now, just by the way, her coaching. So I'm so excited to introduce this phenomenal, amazing woman with an amazing testimony. And I cannot wait for you to hear her interview. So everyone out there listening, ladies and gentlemen, butterflies, I have the pleasure of interviewing Mrs. Kia Riddick Taylor. So I guess
hello.
Hi, Kia. So I hope you are pleased with your intro, but you get all the feels because you are amazing. Even talking to you, your voice is so like calming.
Thank you. And I was in Amsterdam.
Okay. I knew you were somewhere. I was like, wherever it was, because you literally, I was
yeah.
Like, she responded like right back. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we were 6 hours ahead over there. So,
and now how long have you been back in the States?
I've been back for about a month, a little over a month. Wow. Yep.
How's your body adjusting?
I adjusted pretty well coming back. I really didn't have any jet lag, surprisingly. But you know, I'm just adjusting to real life again, which is very hard. So that's a challenge.
And your job sounds, I was going to say your job sounds amazing, but as I was listening, like while you were coaching the kids and I'm in the living room and I'd go upstairs, downstairs, and the way you just took so much time, and I'll get into all that, but you know, that is definitely not for everyone. And I'm so glad that you were available.
Yeah, I love it.
You could just totally tell. So now, for your outline, I always like to do, when I interview people, do outlines based on their profession or what they do. So yours involves clearly TV, movies. So you're dealing with the cast, coach, and characters in a TV script. So I kind of want it to follow, make your podcast questions fall under those headings. They're trying to kind of tie everything in. So I'm first going to start. The first heading I started out with was called The Cast. So now I've read on your website, which you did say, you and I talked earlier and you said you were updating, and and it's still great information regardless. So, but because I was stalking it. But so now I read on your website in your About Me section that when you were growing up, your dad forbid you to watch more than one episode of the Brady Bunch per day because he said, he said you were losing touch with reality. So tell me, that was so interesting to me, because then later on you mentioned that you got an actual call from her.
So, I did. Yeah. So, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the Brady Bunch. I'm assuming most people are, but, I was pretty infatuated with that show. I just thought it was the perfect show. It had, you know, the family got along and the husband and wife really loved each other. They had a maid, which I thought was pretty awesome. And, it was just a really nice blended family. And everyone had a counterpart to that was, close to their age range that they were able to connect with. So I thought that, and I grew up as an only child. So I thought that was great. So I think one day I must've been about five or so. And I asked him why when he came home from work, he didn't come through the door and say, "Hi honey, I'm home." And, like kiss my mom or whatever. And he's like, that Brady Bunch has to go. Life is not a Brady Bunch. And then he, proceeds to go into this tirade about how, life is not a Brady Bunch and all of this. So, fast forward 2 years later, I was working for Nickelodeon and a network called TNN, which is the Nashville network, which is actually that network just changed from being Spike TV to Paramount TV. Oh, so it went from TNN to Spike TV to Paramount TV. But I was working for it when it was TNN.
Okay.
And we had a show, like an improv kind of show that we were doing. And one of the guests that I had to cover as part of my work at Nickelodeon was Marsha Brady, Maureen McCormick.
Oh my gosh.
And it was amazing. And I got so excited by her and enamored by her that I forgot to have her sign her contract. So,
oh my gosh.
So she was staying at a hotel in Manhattan. This was in Queens, and I was living on Long Island at the time. And I had to get to Manhattan the next morning. Yeah. And leave I left the contract for her at the front desk, and I put a lovely note. I said, "Hi, Maureen, it's Kia. So great meeting you last night. In all of our fun, I forgot to have you sign your contract. Could you please sign it and leave it at the front desk?" And she leaves me a message that night. And this is when you had an actual answer machine that you hit play with.
Yes.
So I'm dating myself. And I played the message at some point the next day. And the message was, I wish I still had it. "Hi, Kia, it's Maureen. I just wanted to let you know." And I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, first, so relieved that she signed it, because I could not go to work without having that signed. And second, so like, okay, Dad, you see, this is what I'm talking about.
Right.
All that Brady Bunch, all that daydreaming and TV watching I did, it totally paid off.
Well, and I thought that was so wild when I read that, just how like,
yeah, it was so funny.
It seemed like everything came full circle. And it's funny because you answered my question. I was going to ask you what age you were around that time. So you said you were five. So
I think I was about five. Yeah, I was really young, really young, really young. Yep. And back then they would air back-to-back episodes of the Brady Bunch and shows like that. So you'd have double episodes.
Right.
It was great.
Right. Oh my gosh. Well, and it's funny because when I met you via Skype, you seem like with the inflections in your voice, and I guess, and I'm thinking, duh, Tarea, I guess you have to be that way in order to be a successful coach, but you seem like you could have been an actor. So at any time growing up watching TV, the Brady Bunch, or any of the other different shows, did you always know you wanted to be in entertainment? And if so, did you always want to be on the other side of the camera versus being in front of the camera?
Right. Yeah. I was an only child. So my parents, the TV was the thing that I loved to do most. And, so that was their punishment for me. So if things went wrong, they would take away TV and that would be the end of my world. I would watch it after I did my homework or whatever. or the weekends. But so it wasn't like, I don't feel like I watched as much TV as I feel like kids watch now, because they have, you know, phones and iPads and Netflix and all that stuff. But I definitely watched a good amount, but I wanted to be on TV so bad. And I would look in the paper. I don't know if you remember, in the paper, they would have ads for Barbizon and these camps that were TV and film camps and all of this stuff. And I would circle them and leave them out for them to see. And they're like, no. And, you know, one was we really didn't have disposable income to do things like that. And then two, you know, those things are, you know, they have the appearance of being a scam because you just don't know about them. And so, no, I was never able to kind of fulfill. And the schools that I went to did. I was also kind of a shy kid until I got to high school. But we didn't really have a great theater department and things like that. So it was, and I'm not even sure if we did have it, if I would have even entertained that. I don't know if that was who I was. I was one of those people that definitely wanted to be on TV, but I don't necessarily think I would have had the courage to take the steps to do that.
Okay. So you didn't live vicariously through your feel of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So it was great. And then when I realized, well, I definitely wanted to be Vanessa Huxtable. I mean, who didn't? So that was my big thing. But when I realized that you could go to college and work in TV and film, I was sold. Because initially I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wasn't just a regular lawyer. It had to be an entertainment lawyer because I always wanted to do entertainment. Yep. Always. And then when I found out that you could go to school and major in film and TV, I didn't even know what that entailed. I didn't even know what I wanted to do, but I was in, like, sign me up. So that's, so I always knew, I always knew what I wanted to do. Always. I mean, I was the type of kid that would write people fan letters and, fan letters to, you know, Whitney Houston and, New Edition and, you know, actresses on General Hospital. And and I would have all the responses in my room, and I was in,
so like I was in, like you were, this is what you wanted to do.
Absolutely.
Now it's funny, 'cause I wanted to be a lawyer too, but now see, mine was because I love doing research. And I'll never forget my dad. I forget what we were talking about. And he said, whenever you need, I think I was saying, I don't know if it was about my brothers. And I'm like, they always do this. They always do that. And I couldn't give him a concrete example. And he said to me, whenever you're trying to prove your case, you need to have your, you can't just say, you always do this, or you always say that. You need to have actual facts and instances so you can hit them with a Mike Tyson punch.
Right,
can't
remember.
So I wanted to be a lawyer because I love research, and I love presenting the fact, because you can't argue with facts. So it's funny that you wanted to be a lawyer, and then you were into entertainment, and I wanted to be a lawyer. You know, and I loved LA Law, so I probably thought, you know, exactly. Court is going to be like that, the last minute come rushing in with that information.
Yep, exactly.
Now, what did your parents think about you going into
that field? That,
in school.
Yeah. You know, I think that over the last few years, I've actually had an opportunity to reflect on my parents a lot, because my mom is no longer here, but my dad is. But, you know, just in realizing that so many kids don't get to do what they don't get to follow their passion because it doesn't seem, you know, realistic a lot of times. And I don't know what it, you know, with film and TV or being an actor or actress, I think a lot of times people, because we look at it through this lens, you know, as laymen, but I think what happens is we look at it in a way where like, that's other people. That doesn't happen to people I know, you know? And I think we get caught up in that. So there's, you know, there isn't a great support for it, you know, maybe as a hobby, but you know, what else are you going to do? And people, you know, there's some people that don't even like to, don't even like their kids to go to school, the college for film, for theater. They always want them to have a backup, or, you know, why don't you major in business and then do a theater backup, you know, as a minor or whatever. But my parents, and so one thing I will always be able to say is that they never questioned me. I didn't know what I wanted to do with this degree. They had no idea what I was going to do with this degree, but they still paid for this degree.
Wow.
You know?
So they believed in whatever it was.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And they would, you know, get a little bit of flack from, you know, family members and things like that. And, well, what is that? And what exactly is she doing? And, you know, all of that. And they just, you know, college wasn't easy for us or cheap. So I just really, really, really appreciate the fact that they always allowed me to dream.
Wow.
Which was really, really, I think, instrumental in the foundation that I have now and what I have now. So
that is awesome. I like how you said that they were instrumental in allowing you to dream, mm-hmm. because sometimes I realize as parents and even as adults, and even with the school system and supporting entertainment, you tell your kids you can be whatever you want, except for if it doesn't line up with what we think that you should be.
Right, exactly. What we deem to be realistic or lucrative, or you know, where it's going, you're going to, because you know, as a parent, you want your child to be able to live a good life without your support later on.
Right.
So of course, you know, you're kind of looking at, and you've lived longer than they have, so you're looking at it like, you know, hey, you know, maybe you want to try this, and just in case this doesn't work out or whatever. So I get where it comes from. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, there is, I think you also have to look at who your child is. And if you know that your child is passionate, if you know your child works hard, no matter what, if you know your child, you know, takes challenges and, you know, and runs, sometimes they run from them and sometimes they run to them, you know, but ultimately they end up running. And I think if you just know who your kid is, I think it will help you to support them even when it doesn't necessarily align with how you think their life should be.
That's good when you know who your kid is. Okay.
I like that.
Because I found that outside, like how you said your parents got flack from other people outside mm-hmm. of you guys. I kept questioning my kids, kept saying, are you sure you want to do it? Are you sure you want to do it? Because we live in Maryland, but their manager took a chance and they were very upfront and said, listen, there may be days when I say you need to come up here today. Oh, mm-hmm. guess what? You got to come tomorrow and the next day. Are you really willing to make that commitment? So then I'd hear people say, you know, through the grapevine, oh, it's her that wants them to do it and not them. And I'm thinking, if you knew the headache, like it's 95% work, 5% fun, you know, mm-hmm. at this point in the game. So, but I kept asking them. And finally, my son said, Mom, you don't have to ask us anymore. This is what we want to do. And we're just glad you're letting us do it. So I'm like, okay, great. So I love how you said that, knowing who your kids, you know, are.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So yep. Now you go to college. You have the support of your family.
Yep. And I graduate and I have no idea what I'm doing.
So tell me, take me on the journey. How did you end up at Nickelodeon, one of the biggest kids networks out there?
I went to college and I majored in film and TV. And with a minor in journalism, and you know, you take a good amount. I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, and you take a good amount of core classes, and that have nothing to do with your major. And then you start sprinkling in your major. I don't think that you really get a good handle on, you know, kind of one thing that you want to do.
Okay.
So I came out and I had no idea what I was going to do. It wasn't. I think kids who go in and they're focused on directing or producing or music or whatever, I think they have a more clear vision.
Okay.
But the business entails so many different aspects and divisions. So those weren't what I kind of aspired to. So it made it harder for me to really understand what I wanted to do. I just knew I needed to work in the business. So I came out and I, you know, tried my luck in Philadelphia for a while. I think I had this one job interview for one of the news networks, and I got really far, and it was for a news assistant, which is great because I can come in and, you know, start to learn that and work my way up, hopefully. And I got the call, and I had said to myself, this is about a year after I graduated, I said to myself, if I don't get this, I'm going back to New York. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get it. But the man who called me, he said I made it to the final three.
Wow.
Out of, I think at that time it was like 300 applicants. So I had said that's what I was going to do if I didn't get that, because it didn't make sense for me to be in Philadelphia and not, you know, to be working a regular job. I could do that at home.
Okay.
So yeah, so I moved back home and I just started looking for jobs. And the funny thing is, I always tell this story because it's so different now. You know, back then you basically, it was who you knew, but also you looked in a newspaper.
Right.
So I get my newspaper and I'm looking. I have no idea what I'm looking for. I look for a job in my newspaper. And one day I see a job that says something about, do you want to break into TV? Yes, I do. So I circle it. I send my resume off to some P.O. box. And that was it. And then I never thought about it twice. And then I get a call about a week before Thanksgiving one year, and the same year, and I had been back for a few months now.
Okay.
And I get a call from MTV Networks, and I'm like, okay. So they asked me to come in for an interview for this videotape operator. So basically, the person who runs all of the network. So if you're watching Nickelodeon, there's someone who's running that network.
Okay.
Someone who's airing the graphics and the shows and the little, back then it was, you know, all the PG-13s and whatever that stuff is, the ratings. So I go, okay. So I go in and she's interviewing me, and she says, it's for MTV Networks, and it's basically where they air all of their programming. So it's anything that Viacom owns. So all the MTVs, all the Nickelodeons, all the Showtimes, everything. Yeah. So she finishes the interview and she explains what the job is. It's basically a videotape operator. And I say to her, how did you find my resume? I don't remember submitting to MTV Networks. And she said, you didn't. You submitted to a blind ad. And I said, oh, yeah. So basically, they didn't want to put an ad in the paper that said, hey, come work for MTV Networks. And they wanted to filter out people.
Wow.
So the ad was very generic. It had no company, no network attached to it. Just, you know, basically videotape library. I think the ad was actually to work in the library in the building, which is basically where you all the, because back then everything's on a server now, but back then they were all like physical tapes.
Okay.
So you would organize that and make sure all the departments had their shows for the day and all of that. But but she said when I submitted for that, she thought I was overqualified. So she waited until a tape operator position
that
opened up. Yeah.
Wow.
So basically, because I applied to a blind ad, because I didn't leave any stone unturned, I think is why I ended up where I ended up.
That is, that's what I was going to say. You could have very well easily overlooked it, but you...
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it was great. So through MTV Networks and this division of Viacom, basically, they have a program, though they had a program, it was called the Employee Development Program. And that program actually enabled you to, on your days off, to go and work in another division within Viacom. And it was kind of an internship, and you actually got time and a half for it, which was crazy. So,
Viacom is huge. Like.
Yeah. So after a year and a half, after a year or so, you become eligible to apply for that program. So and this job that I had was in 12-hour shifts.
Okay.
So, two 12-hour days, 2 days off, 3 days on, 2 days off, 3 days off, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So in the course of the 2 weeks, you would have maybe five actual days that you could be off during a week. So, I applied for this program and I knew exactly where I wanted to go. They had a position open in the Nickelodeon talent department. So I went and interviewed with them, and they were like, great, awesome. So I did this internship basically, but which was really hard and humbling for me because I've graduated college. I'm already working a full-time job that, you know, has benefits.
Right.
And now I'm going to go and get, you know, coffee or run copies or, you know, edit tapes.
So
or,
you really did do that. Like you really.
Yes. I did that at the same time that I was working for the company, which again, it was great because I wasn't making a lot of money in the position I had. Mm. So this helped me to offset, you know, some expenses in life. And it got me a chance to get in the door, because the other thing I didn't mention was that I was never able to do a real internship in college because I never had the money to, because in order to do an internship, you have to, you know, you do it for credit back then. And I was always paying my previous semester's bill right before, like my bill was always just paid before I had to register again.
Mm-mm,
so I never had, you know, I was never, my bill was never clean enough for me to do like a summer internship or anything like that.
But look,
yeah. So I, you know, I just said, this is my internship, and it was humbling and great. And then I did that for about 12 weeks, and then I went back and just continued to do the one job, you know, at the MTV Networks full-time again. Well, it was always still full-time, but just only that aspect of it. And then I got a call maybe, I don't know, a month or so after I left the Nickelodeon internship, and they said that their casting assistant was leaving. And they had a position, and I was like, okay. So I went in to interview for that, and I was talking to someone who works there, and she was talking to me, and she said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I don't know casting. I don't really know. She said, okay, so what's the worst that happens? You take the job, you do it for a year. If you don't like it, you do something else. And I was like, oh, I've never thought of that. Like, right. Okay. So, so I did. So I accepted it. And then as luck would have it, well, it was kind of lucky for me, but not so great for my boss, who I was really assisting. She was pregnant and she had a really difficult pregnancy. So she actually ended up working from home most days. And because of that, I really didn't have to assist her the way I was brought into. So then I could jump into doing my own project. So I started doing, they started throwing me on-air promos to cast for. Okay. Voiceovers and on-camera promos and things like that. So I just took that and ran with it. And then eventually I was like the casting person for the whole on-air promo group and for Nickelodeon.
And that's what I was going to, that, okay, because that's amazing. And then just for the people that are listening now, and just, and I think I'm right. Look, I still could be wrong, but for going, when my kids go in for these things, something will say promo. And is that just like,
yes,
is that like interstitials or?
Yeah, promo is basically a promotion. It's not a commercial because it's for the actual network that it's airing on.
Got it.
So if it was Nickelodeon, we might be doing a promo for SpongeBob.
Okay.
And it's airing on SpongeBob. It's on airing on Nickelodeon. If you were doing that same, if you then took that SpongeBob promo and you aired it, say, on something they don't own, like NBC, then it becomes a commercial.
Okay.
So a promo is your promotion for your content, for your on-air content.
Okay. And you became the head of?
I did all the casting for the promo group, on-air group. And that consisted of all the Nickelodeon brands. So it's Nickelodeon, it's TV Land, it's Nick at Night.
You did all of them?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then we started having digital channels and all of that. So I became the person that was, so if anyone in promos had a casting request, they would come to me.
And it was a lot of promo.
I mean, now I don't think it's as much. And these were promos where you would cast regular people and, you know, voiceovers. Now I think they do a lot of promos that are just, you know, bits of their own shows or they're using talent from their own shows a lot. So I don't know if it's as much of, I think it's just a little different now.
Well, I'm thinking about just watching back then. I remember watching and it was a lot. So I can't even imagine, like, do you ever look back and think, how did you, like, as one person?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we have interns and things like that, but it really, you know, and then eventually, you know, you can always, if there's an assistant in the department, you know, that person can help you. And this was also in the days where you know, everything is so quick now with email, but I'm faxing out breakdowns to agents, you know, telling them what I'm looking for and getting faxes back. And it's actually a paper list that someone wrote and of names. And it's so funny when I think about how things are so different now.
Versus now through the, because I know we get a lot of emails like update your profile. So
your actor's access. Exactly.
That is so, it's
just, so then from there, just grew within the company there. Yep.
Now, okay. So then with it being Nickelodeon, and now I know that as a casting director, if you're casting for a promo, sometimes you're not just going to see 10 or 15. Sometimes you may see so many, kids or adults, and they're doing the same script that you've seen over and over again. So how did you keep it? So how were you able to approach this job so that it didn't become repetitive and monotonous, and that you were able to focus on really casting that person you thought was right?
I think that, and I think that's what you see with casting directors is that, I think what you see with casting directors is the creative part of it, which people don't realize is that, you know, it's the approach that you use to find the talent. So it's not necessarily going to your staples, but also, you know, we did a lot of scouting, going to schools and, performing arts high schools and, the professional, performing school for kids in New York, and you know, different shows and theaters and things like that, and really just kind of scratching, you know, underneath the surface, I think is what keeps it interesting. And then also, everyone, you realize you're doing the same script, but there are different personalities attached to the script, which makes it different. You know, your choices, that the way your brain thinks is not necessarily the way my brain thinks. So our choices might be different. Your personality, I can tell a lot from a person when they just walk in and say hi to me, in a casting session. It's just, you know, it's, you can just kind of tell. So it definitely, and then the diversity of the projects and what you're looking for, you know, that definitely helps to keep it, you know, fresh. And so I think a lot of it is, you know, it's just the variables keep it fresh. Yeah. And just making sure you're not getting complacent and just kind of, you know, okay, well, here it is. Because, and also, no one wants to see the same exact people every single time. So yeah, you've got your core base. There's always a core group that, you know, like, these people are bookers. These people are strong. And then you can sprinkle in other people who you don't necessarily know yet or know as well, but there's something about, maybe their headshot that interests you, or maybe the agent pitched you on them, and, you know, and then you can kind of say, you know, sprinkle in your session with those people as well. And I think it all kind of, you know, evens out.
Okay. So now I want to ask you, what is it about you that from your perception of yourself, because you've been very successful from all the internet Googling I was doing, to me, you seem very successful in your casting career. Plus, again, my kids, and I keep, for those of you listening, I keep referencing my kids, because again, that's how I met Kia, and she'll tell you, I'm like emailing her with excitement, talking to her, whatever. But, they're with Shirley Grant Management, who is fair to who, worked perfectly for us in our situation, but you know, they're fairly, well known. So to me, I take
absolutely,
and I take their recommendation very seriously, because they just don't randomly say, go for this person. So when, so for them to recommend you, I mean, just right off the bat. And then, so what is it about you, being aware of yourself that you think maybe sets you apart from other casting directors or other coaches? What is it about Kia that's different than all the others?
You know, I don't know if it's different than all the others. I think that, because I think there are so many talented, you know, now we're kind of segueing into my coaching, my coaching career, which I went from Nick casting to coaching talent directly. And I just think for me, I think that's also, I think what I'm about to tell you is really part of the reason why I continue to do well, is that I, it gets really hard, because there are people that, there are tons of people, especially if you look at New York and LA, and there are tons of people that do this. There's coaches everywhere. There are classes everywhere. And it's so hard. It's so competitive. And, you know, there's only a finite number of, you know, people looking for these services. And also remember, these services aren't necessarily cheap. So, you know, you're not getting, you know, a three dance classes for $25. it's one of those things where you do feel that sense of competition as well. And I've done a lot of work on myself to remember who I am at my core. And it's a work in progress, but I really feel good about kind of where I am at this point, because the biggest thing to remember is that I'm me. There is no other me. There, you know, my personality is my personality. My approach is my approach. You know, we all kind of share the same fundamentals, because I was telling one of my students this the other day, the core language and the vocabulary of the craft is the same. It's been the same since, you know, Stella Adler and Stanislavski and Meisner. It's all pretty much the same. So you don't really adjust that so much. But I think that my relationships with people enable them to be more vulnerable. And I think that is kind of where my strength lies. I really am able to connect with people. And I work really hard on, you know, it's a focus on the business, on the craft, but it's also a focus on my students as people.
Okay.
Because I feel like, you know, if you're more comfortable with who you are as a person, if you're more comfortable with, if you are more empathetic as a person to others, I think that, you know, those are things that will help you to receive what you need to receive in terms of the actual craft.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And allow them to be more vulnerable, like you said.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. More vulnerable, more accessible, more, you know, it's a very intimate relationship, you know?
Yes.
And it's not just about, again, it's not just about the technique of it. It really, there's a connection that people have to feel like when you're talking to them through a computer screen or a phone or a TV or a film screen, that that you're talking to them, you know, they need to be able to feel that connection. And the only way to feel that connection is if they truly allow themselves to be seen. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And I love how you brought it when I mentioned what was different about you than, let's say, other casting directors, other coaches. You didn't, you took the focus off of, even though I'm asking you about you, you still, you took the focus off of others and brought it back to you and the work that you did on self. And I like how you were honest and saying, because it's a lot of competition out there. So you
it's a struggle
who you are.
Absolutely.
I love how you said that, because so often people will say, well, it's because most people are like this, but I'm like this. And you said, no,
right.
I recognize there's a lot of competition. So I had to focus on me. So I love that. I'm going to take that for me. Sometimes
even in your world, you're doing, you know, podcasts. There's a pod. I'm always listening to a podcast, always listening in my car, and, you know, and when I'm taking a bath, whatever. And there are so many people, and there are so many people doing podcasts that, you know, that you have different genres, and then you kind of have this, like, you know, mind, body, spirit type of genre. Yes. Everybody has got something to say, you know?
Yes.
And so how do you maintain who you are and do what you need to do when that's what you're faced with, you know?
You are so right. And I was going to, because I have, like, if you look at the podcast I listen to, like you said, they range from different genres, and some of them are so popular. And I had, for a while, I had caught myself saying, well, maybe if I segue over into this space, and then I was like, no, that's not who you are.
I also realized that early on too. You know, I'm like, okay, well, maybe if I change this class, or maybe if I do that, or maybe, and I'm like, nope, that's not the way to do it. Not the way to do it. You can't do it that way, because when you do it that way, you're going against who you are at your core.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's something you have a word for. I'm going to start calling you Coach Kia myself, even privately. Coach Kia. And so, speaking of coach, now I'll segue into, so your first, the first section of questions was the cast, as you were the casting director. Now the second set is the coach. Mm-hmm. So in this, I purposely waited to give the meaning of the word cast. Even though cast was first. Again, that's the word I used in the first section of this interview. Now, while the word cast has many various meanings, the one that stuck out to me the most was the one that defined the word cast as the distinctive form in which a thing is made. I noticed within the meaning of cast was the word distinctive, which actually means marking as separate or different, serving to distinguish. So you started in casting, and now you've moved into coaching. And I've had the pleasure and benefit of having both of my children work with you for a coaching session based on a recommendation. And I can honestly say that I see why people and parents come to you for their children. You're a coach, and you have a very distinct way that you have your clients, the people that you're coaching, form their characters that sets them apart from the way others would form those same characters. And it's, to me, as I was listening to you, it almost felt like you literally had my kids, your clients, take a character and you had them break it down in every possible thought, feeling, or action that the character could have had. So you made them give depth and layer to the different characters. And having to coach someone to do that is definitely a huge undertaking. So that's why I gave the meaning of the word cast later, because it was saying it was the distinctive form in which a thing is made. And then distinctive means separate. And I noticed, I mean, I truly was listening to you, and the way you just went in, and it, even though you were dealing with the character, you were also dealing with my children and pulling something out of them that was different than what they were used to.
Right.
So I just think that's like, how did you, and I guess that's just a gift.
It's funny. Lately I started journaling. So I've been journaling consistently for on and off for about 2 years, but consistently for probably the last 6 months, where I'm about to finish my first one, where like really finish it. And
it's not gonna be a book
halfway. No, it's just my journal. Okay, and it's just not, you know, because normally I get a few pages in, and I'm one of those people that loves to buy journals, and I love the idea of it, but I just don't have the discipline. But I'm about 2 pages from finishing an actual journal.
Wow.
And one of the things I've been able to kind of uncover through my journaling is that this is a gift, because I really don't have a way to explain it. In college, you know, as you prepare for your projects, part of your projects, they're, you know, they encompass everything. So if you're doing a project, you know, based on the professor's specs, you've got to cast your project. You've got to do this. You've got to edit. You've got to do music, like all the elements. But you don't really spend a ton of time on casting, you know?
Okay.
People always ask me, how do you get into casting? Like, what do you do? And I'm every casting director I know just kind of fell into it pretty much.
Okay.
I think now it's way more popular. And I think, which is, thank goodness, casting directors are getting the accolades that they so rightfully deserve. So it's becoming more of it as an actual occupation that, you know, people are looking at as a viable option for them, which is great. But years ago, it was, everyone fell into it. So I don't really have a way to explain my ability, except to say that it really is a gift. I've started to acknowledge that it's a gift, and not try and justify it being a gift, because I think we also do that too. Even when we realize something's a gift, we try and justify it, because a gift just doesn't sound like you did anything.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
But we did. Like I did. I put my, you know, I do have the gift, but I have the choice of what I'm going to do with that gift. You know, I can, you know, have a choice on whether or not I'm going to, you know, continue to grow it and develop it and use my resources to do that. So, but yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's a gift. I do. I'm finally at the point in my life where I can own that.
And I love that you said that you can own it and not try to, like you said, justify or even downplay. Mm-hmm. Because I heard someone say that we're quick to tell other people, oh yeah, that's a gift. And mm-hmm. But then if the person says, yes, you're right, it is. Sometimes people almost get offended. Like, well, what do they mean? Yes, mm-hmm. it's a gift. And it's like, no, we need to own. This is a gift that you were given.
Exactly.
And like you said, you're nurturing it. You cultivated it. So I think.
Yeah, that's exactly. Because awesome. I know I'm guilty of it. I have spent a lot of time thinking about what I don't do well. You know,
yes.
Oh, I wish I could do that, or I wish I did that well, or I wish, man, and I do. I'm quick to identify a gift in someone. Wow, you can draw? That is a gift. You know,
mm-hmm.
And we're quick to identify when people are wasting their gift as well.
Yes. Very true.
Yeah, but I definitely think it's a gift for sure.
So now, with that being said, you knowing it was a gift, was that something that helped you take the leap from working? Here you are working with this major networking casting.
Mm-hmm.
So your name is known, you're known, you've worked your way up through the ranks. So now you decide that you're going to move into coaching. And you not only moved careers, you actually physically moved locations. So how were you able to just take a leap of faith and do that?
I think that it was because I never thought that it's similar to how I've approached, and it's really not an approach. It's just kind of who I am, well, who I was until, you know, you're different when things start to realize the, how important things are. So okay. Before I realized how important things are, I just kind of, you know, this is what I want to do. And I'm going to go try and do that. Okay. I never thought about what would happen if I didn't. If it didn't work or something like that. And for me, once I thought about, I moved because I was getting married, and my husband was living in Orlando at the time, and we had dated years ago. So when we reconnected, he was already in Orlando.
Oh.
And I made the decision. We tried to figure out like who would leave and would he come back up north and would I, you know, go down there. And I felt at the time that I was ready to make a change, because I think also what happens when you grow up in a major company and it's a great company, I was very coddled in terms of, I didn't know the real world. You know, their casting directors on the real world are, you know, they do a project and they're trying to get another one. For me, the projects just keep coming because it's part of a network. We're part of a development team, part of a, you know, a PR team, part of a marketing team. So it's more of a, you know, a family kind of thing. So one, I knew I was getting a little complacent, which I don't like, because then it makes me afraid of what could happen, you know, in a few years when I try and go out into the real world. So complacency, definitely. And two, one of the things I really loved about casting was the moments when I identified that someone, there was something there. Because, you know, you've been taking your children to casting sessions. Sometimes they last 2 minutes.
Yes.
And you're like, wow, that was it. And, you know, so there isn't a lot of time in the room to do what you need to do. You got to be ready, you know, to take advantage of the room. And but there are times when, you know, I wasn't backed up, you know, with wall-to-wall people where I could actually either keep you in the room a little bit longer and really work with you. Or even I would do things where I would bring people back in. And without the producers or directors, because these are people that I wanted to get ready for the producers or directors. Mm-hmm. And I would bring people back in and work with them and get them to the point. And there was one kid where I got him to the point where he went to the kind of the final round for a Spike Lee project that we were working on.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was just a kid from, I want to say like an after school program or some sort of he really didn't have a lot of experience at all. So it's those moments that I really felt great about the casting process. You know, those moments, you know, I had one moment where I was working and on a project, and this girl, I think she was about 12 at the time. She was good. It was like an improv based project, which, you know, is hard. Mm-hmm. So she was good. But, you know, I let her go. I was like, okay, great. Thank you. And then I couldn't even see the next person because I said, I let her go. I think I should bring her back for callbacks tomorrow. So I ran and called her agent. They're like, oh, she's from Canada and blah, blah, blah. Let's call and see if they can stay around. And sure enough, she said that girl is actually a great actress now too. But it was just something that, you know, it's that instinct, that gut feeling that you can't ignore.
Okay.
But yeah, for me, I really feel like that those were the moments that I really, really loved, being able to give someone that chance to learn and do better. So I knew that when I moved to Florida, that was exactly what I wanted to do when I got here, is that I wanted to have a studio.
And I love how you're so in tune with yourself, and you're not, again, you're not dismissive of that feeling. Like you had to stop before you could go on to that next person and say, wait a minute.
Yep.
Did I just
exactly
and,
exactly.
And it's funny because your gift, it's funny how someone's gift cultivates the gift in someone else. And that's what yours does. It like cultivates the gifts in other people that they didn't know they had, or brings out the depth of their gift. So, wow, that's really good. And you answered one of my questions that I was going to ask, which is great, because I was going to ask you, were you ever in casting sessions and the coach part of you kind of?
Oh, yeah. Yep, exactly. Yep. Exactly.
That's awesome.
And even if I do a project now, I might do a casting part, you know, a small project here and there. I did worked on a couple of movies when I first, well, not when I first got here, but a couple of years after I got to Florida. But other than that, I don't do casting. But even when I do, like, I find myself, you know, trying to coach the performance.
That's awesome. I love it. Okay. So now I did have one last question under coach. I was going to skip it, but I'm really interested because you seem so confident in what you're doing and in the transition that you made with you getting married and deciding, you know what, I'm just going to move. And I love how you decided you were thinking far enough ahead to know that I will become complacent. Not even that I will become if I stay here. So you had enough forethought to almost make provisions for that, you know, in your, what was your current reality at that time? But was there any point in time that even for a second, like in the transition, you second guessed yourself and almost went back?
No, I've never second guessed myself or almost went back, but I have definitely had moments of despair because it wasn't easy. It wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. It was a very humbling experience for me to, and that's what I was saying earlier about how I used to just kind of, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I really didn't think about what would happen if it didn't work out. And now that, you know, I'm here, I'm newly married, I want to do my part to contribute to the household. I felt this intense pressure to do it and to do it well and to do it right. And so that was a little stressful. And then, you know, coming here and saying, hey, I was casting director for Nickelodeon and blah, blah. I had one woman, an agent who used to be here. She said, well, we already have acting schools. And I was like, oh, okay. Wow. Great. And I was like, wow. So this whole Nickelodeon thing works at Nickelodeon, but not necessarily, you know. And I just found it to be hard to break in here and to do, you know, it's hard. And everyone, whenever there's someone new in town, people, oh yes, this is great, this person came and they're great and we're gonna try them out, and then they do, and then they either they're not connected or committed to keep going, or they just do go to the next person, or maybe they have a person they really like, or they don't really like you as much as they thought they would, whatever. But it definitely was a humbling experience for me. I mean, even my husband, he does market research, and he would say, well, let's make flyers and put them in cars. And I'm like, I don't do flyers in cars. What do you mean? Like, I work for people call me. I don't do flyers in cars. And I ended up having to do like flyers in cars type of situations. Wow. And it was very grassroots. And I, thankfully, this woman gave me a shot, and she, because the other thing is too, how do you have acting classes without a space? But how do you have a space without students to pay for the space? So I had, so I was like, oh, what would I do if I was in New York? There's tons of places in New York that will rent you just a space for the night you want to have a class or whatever.
Okay.
So there's none of that here. So I started looking at dance studios, because I figure there has to be a time where maybe they're not using the space. And I found this woman who didn't do classes on Sundays at all. And she rented me 2 hours on Sundays for $35 an hour.
What?
Yep. And what I did, I had pillows. I still have some of the pillows. I had like these great pillows and little stools. And I put them in my car on Sundays. And I went and, four people in the class, five people in the class, three people in the class. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then it got to the point where we started to get a little traction, and we realized we have to get a space.
Okay.
So we got a space, but even getting that was scary, because you're like, oh my gosh, we have this space. It's way more than $35 an hour, you know? Oh my gosh, how are we going to pay? So then I have the pressure of, that's the other thing you can't let happen to you. You can't let the pressure of what you, of like the, you know, how much something costs, affect you in a way that you are going to make choices that are not conducive to your brand, you know, because easily I could have just said, okay, well, I'm just going to do these things. And, I'm going to just do things that would turn over a quick buck so I could pay the rent, because I'm worried now about paying rent. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But, you know, I just, thank goodness for my husband. I really was able to stick to the core of, and also, because, you know, he has a regular stable job, it definitely enabled me to kind of figure this out a little bit more than I normally would have been able to. Right. And my parents were very supportive, you know. You know, they'll buy a TV for the studio, or they gave us, you know, $1,000 one time, and we're like, we're making you partners. And every year they'd be like, so do we get our payout? And I'm like, no, we'll just roll over your money,
right,
you know?
We'll just roll it over.
Yeah. But it's, wow. You know, stuff like that really, you know, but it was very humbling for me. Very humbling.
Well, I love the fact that you said, number one, I don't do flyers, because you get to a certain point. And you think like, and it's funny, I'm listening to you and you are so in my head right now. This is so great, because people think like, just because I'm interviewing, I've asked God to help me to be able to, you know, stay in the interview, but also me myself gain some, because you can always learn.
Uh-huh.
You said the exact words. You said grassroots. And last week I did a podcast and I said, I'm normally in different things in life used to being able to use my words and coming up with something off the top of my head, and people saying, oh my gosh, you have great ideas and you have great skills, and it being easy. And I feel like God has put me in connection with some great people. I mean, look, I'm talking to the casting director from Nickelodeon. I've interviewed someone from BET. I've interviewed these different people, and God is like, okay, and you still have to plant the seed, till the ground, harvest the seed, and then I got to distribute the seed. And I said, I definitely said, he told me, you're doing grassroots work because, you know, so I'm like, when you said that, it just truly hit me. And then about the money, not letting money, because now I'm trying to interview multiple people and I don't want to have to deal with, you got to share a mic and then I have a mic. So my husband just said, go ahead and take the next step and buy three more mics and bigger equipment. And I'm like, but that's, you know, X amount of dollars.
More money. I know. But it's one of those things. And my husband said, he's like, well, is this a hobby or is this a career? Like, what do you want to do with this? So we just have to figure it out and you have to make adjustments. So, but yeah, it definitely, it was humbling for me to come here and have to call people. Hi, I'm Kia. And it's just so awkward.
I was going to say awkward because before you could lead with Nickelodeon and the doors would swing open, and now you're like, should I even say
and, it? And after I got here and I was here for, I don't know, maybe 11 months, and then I got sick. So the whole time that I'm, the whole time that I'm trying to work on this, you know, just figuring out who's here, who are the competitors, what do I need to do? But that whole time I'm doing that, I have one workshop. I put together a workshop, and it was great. It was a 2-day workshop. I had about 9 or 10 kids. That I don't even know how I found them, but it was great. And then a few weeks later, I got sick and it took me out the game for another year and a half.
And that's just what, Kia, I don't know if you are because you've been doing it so long, I'm like, she's literally like in every, like.
No, it's literally because that's how my life has literally been one. It just kind of, all these things just kind of like, there's like a puzzle. They work together.
And my outline just went right in because my next, the very last, and I'm calling them headings, but for lack of a better word, heading on your outline is titled The Character, only it's not a script. It's your real life. So now in regard to your actors and coaching, I've read that you've said the following. Anytime you're given a script, you're getting prepared to go on a journey, a mysterious journey that starts with your willingness to explore with empathy, without judgment, and without attachment to the end result. And I found that to be such a beautiful statement. And when I read it, it created a picture in my mind for me, because when I read things, my mind immediately shows me, a picture.
The visualization.
Yes, a visualization, exactly. And, you know, that statement is such an accurate statement when it comes to acting. You go on this journey, you've got to be willing to explore without judgment and not be attached to what happens at the end. But then I started thinking and wondering what happens when you've decided to take a leap of faith, as you did. You left New York to come to Orlando and not only leave a job that's familiar, but you left the area of familiarity. You know, you didn't have a safety net. And then what happens when you're sent on your journey that you thought you had written out so clearly? I work for Nickelodeon. These doors should open, only for another scene to come into play. And that scene, you discover you've been diagnosed with a sickness.
Yes. Ovarian cancer. Okay. Yep. So 11 months, I think three weeks before my first wedding anniversary, which is when I moved here, it was right after I got married, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And so that took me out of so that took me out of, my husband, we always tell the story about how he was in the waiting room because we didn't think it was ovarian cancer. Cancer was never even like, I was operated on by a gynecologic oncologist, which is what you should be operated on if there's any suspicion of cancer there in that region. But, the doctor, he felt pretty strongly that it was maybe fibroids.
Wow.
Because apparently fibroids run predominant or pretty heavy in minority women.
Okay.
And African-American women in particular. And so he was really, not too concerned. And, I had another blood test and it was kind of, nothing really pointed us into that direction definitively. And that's the thing with ovarian cancer is that there really is no definitive test that says, hey, take this test and then you will know.
Got it.
So that's the problem with it. That's why so many people find out so late. So I get diagnosed. My husband's in the waiting room. And, when I first go in, he's like looking up things for us to do for our anniversary. And then a doctor comes out and tells him what he found. And he quickly adjusts to searching up all things ovarian cancer. Man. And it's just, you know, in a matter of seconds, his, you know, entire world
changed.
Yeah. Yep. So, and you know, it's not an easy cancer. It's not a, it's one that is definitely, you know, a lot of people don't survive. It's doing way better these days. So I feel very lucky. I mean, you, one of the things you asked me, I didn't want to get into it then because I figured you were probably going to talk about it at some point. But I think one of the reasons why I am in Florida is because of that. I think because I was forced to slow down. I had this time while I'm trying to, you know, get my license done and look for a house and, you know, like figure out how to be married and all those things and figure out this business. So I wasn't working the hours that I normally work at Nickelodeon. And I think I was able to, it wasn't that I felt anything in my body. It was really just that I was able to make these doctor's appointments and I had nothing else to do. Let me just go use my new insurance, you know? So I did all that. And I think that that's a big reason as to why. And then this doctor that I had was incredible, like saved my life. I totally, and New York has some of the best cancer hospitals in the world. The problem is, getting into them or the time it takes to, you know what I mean? Like this, I went to this regular GYN. He had a referral for me to go to this gynecologic oncologist, Dr. Finkler at Florida Hospital, had me go to him in maybe a couple of days. And I mean, this whole thing was maybe 2 weeks instead of 2 months.
Wow. So
2 months, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. No.
Man.
Nope. So I definitely think that, part of the reason I was supposed to be, and I also think I told you I met my husband, we dated years ago before I left Philadelphia for the last time. And he, you know, I honestly think that he was supposed to be on this journey with me. Like, I really think that the whole thing was definitely in the plan.
Designed and just planned out for
yeah,
your life.
Mm-hmm. Like I do.
A part of your journey that you just had to step on blind faith, basically every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
You're just stepping out, even though, and what I love about your story is that even in your assuredness, there still had to be a lack of, I mean, there still had to be an abundance of faith.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. And the thing is, I'm not super religious. I'm more, I would say I'm more spiritual. Mm-hmm. But there's no other choice. I think faith happens automatically when you're diagnosed with something like cancer, mm-hmm. because you have no choice but to move forward. Like you don't even have time to think like, oh, this, hopefully this works. I mean, you just are moving, you know, there's treatments you have to set up. There's procedures and surgeries. And you do, every single time you get a second to stop and think about it for a second, something else is happening. You have to address it. So you really just don't have the time. You have to keep moving forward.
And I like that. You said you don't have the time. You just have to keep moving forward. Like, you said, making, you know, doctor's appointments and this treatment and that treatment. And it doesn't allow you to throw yourself a pity party.
Nope. And you can have one. And the good thing is that, you know, hopefully you have someone, whether it's a husband or a boyfriend or a parent or a sibling or best friend, but hopefully you have someone that allows you to have the pity party and then, but also says, okay, we're done with the pity party for today. Let's go out and do whatever, or let's watch a movie, or because you got to let people have the pity party
because
it is a horrible thing.
Yeah.
So anyone who would say to me, well, you know, don't cry or what, I just, I'm like, well, why not? Because this is how I'm feeling right now.
And that's I like, it's like, you can go there. You just decided not to stay there.
Exactly.
We all have human, that's the whole reason we have these emotions and these expressions And if you had kept it up inside, that could have been toxic for what was already
absolutely
going in your body.
Absolutely. Yeah. So then I can go into chemo and crack a few jokes and, you know, and then I go to sleep and then I eat. I gained probably, I don't know, 35, 40 pounds on chemo, which is what people don't generally. People generally lose. Not me. I was eating everything. It was the only thing that I would have the day that I came home from chemo. I'd be out of it. I'd sleep for probably about a day and a half.
Okay.
And then when I wake up from that, I'd start to slowly start eating. And then by, you know, 3 or 4 days later, I'm like, oh, where is the Chinese food? Where's the chicken from our local supermarket? Publix, that's great. Where's the, you know? And at that point, my husband, and then he gained probably like 30 pounds in solidarity
because he's eating
with me. Yeah. So, just trying to get these, you know, now it's 30 plus and trying to get all these pounds off, and it's years later. So,
but you're here.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Wow.
So
exactly.
How long did, from the time you were diagnosed until the time you were in, because it's considered remission?
I guess it is. I've never really used that word. Okay. I'm like, it's gone.
Okay,
and you know,
it does
have a high, ovarian has a high recurrence rate, which is interesting because before I had cancer, I didn't even realize that cancers came back. I think I knew, but because I've never really had anyone that close to me that dealt with it, I really didn't recognize that for some people it comes back, and it comes back often. No matter what you do, you know. So that was kind of earth-shattering for me. I'm like, this can come back? Like, what? But I was operated on by the best. I had two surgeries. One, he took out just, you know, a fallopian tube and an ovary, because that was what was impacted.
Okay.
But after the test came back and all that, he said we need to take out everything. And so I did 8 rounds of chemo instead of 6, because okay, I was younger then, and he thought I could tolerate it, which I did. And then we went in for a full hysterectomy after that. So this man, I was, you know, he was really aggressive, and he was just the person that I needed at that time. One of the first people to have this surgery using the Da Vinci robot, which is really popular now for surgeries. And, you know, and that's a great robot to, or surgery to have a robot with, because, you know, that through the robot, you can see things that the eyes can't see.
Oh, wow.
So I really feel like that was another thing that gave me a great advantage, was that, you know, I was able to have everything I needed to have. My healthcare was good. And that was another thing. My healthcare is good, and there's people next to me that don't have great healthcare. And so that was very stressful. So I'm very vocal about healthcare and the disparities. Exactly. But I got diagnosed in October of 07, and I had my hysterectomy, and I finished all my chemo in March of 08. So about 6 months. And then I had my hysterectomy in July of 08. And then after that, all my numbers were clear and everything. So I would go back to the doctor. First, it was every 3 months. Then years later, it became every 6 months. And then it became, it was every 6 months probably until last late 2017 when they finally released me. So they released me after about, so I guess it's been 10 years. So they released me.
That is awesome. And again, you blew my mind again, because you said, when you said you don't use that word, and then you said, you guess you knew, but you never really thought about it. And you were like, it could come back. Like the way you've approached everything in your life, from this is what I'm going to college for, to I'm sending this resume to the PO box, to I'm going to do this internship, even though it's crazy hours, to I'm going to go in for Nickelodeon, I'm going to take this on, to I'm going to move to Florida, I'm going to hand out the flyers. It was like you never thought that it wouldn't work. Like,
right.
There's been nothing,
right.
Even if you had a little bit of
apprehension
and fear, you never let that stop you.
No, it's so true. And then, you know, so now, my philosophy for, you know how for every year people are now starting to do these power words.
Yes.
So I don't have a power word for 2018, but I have a philosophy or a motto that I'm following, and two of them. And one is to dwell in possibility. Because the more I know, the more I feel like it limits it limits me, because I know better. I often say, well, that won't work.
Because you know, okay.
Because I know better. So, you know, well, that's not the way it goes, or that's not the way you're supposed to do it, right? So my thing is to now dwell in possibility, and to basically say, well, why not? Well, okay. Well, what does it really hurt to try, you know? So that's one. And then my second one is old ways don't open new doors. Old ways don't open new doors. So that every time I go to do something that I, you know, a bad habit that I have, or I think twice about making a move or whatever the case might be, and I think about what would I normally do? And if that's what I would normally do, then I have to adjust it.
Because
old ways don't open new doors.
New doors. Man,
nope. You can take that from everything to eating, to exercising,
right.
to
well, that's immediately what I thought of. I'm like, well, I guess I'm not going to go to 7-Eleven when we're done and get the cookies and cream Hershey, because I had a little piece today. I don't need a whole
Right.
Color bar.
So. Right. So your old way to be would be to go get one.
Yep.
You know,
after already having some, but mm-hmm. now it's like, no, but the new way is no, you had some moderation, keep it moving.
Exactly. And that way, yeah. And so those are my two, you know, that's kind of how I'm living. Because like I said, I think my biggest problem now in life is that because I do know a lot and I know better, I start to limit myself. And so it's like there are these self-imposed limits.
Yes, self-imposed. And then I think that's one of the great things I think I miss about being a child. They think anything is possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's
yep.
nothing impossible.
Yeah, you can't tell them nothing. I'm watching, you know, a little bit of my husband's really watching and I'm kind of co-watching, but the Olympics, and I'm looking at these kids and these stories. You want to talk about parents who are supportive?
Yes.
Man, yes. Parents, who, and they're not supportive saying, I saw one story, I can't think of the little girl's name, other girl's name, but she, I think she's a snowboarder, but her parents would, you know, she jumps off chairs. They have all these home videos. She's jumping off chairs. She's riding a scooter in the house. She's doing all these things that some parent might deem to be, you know, like not the best use of a child's time or inappropriate mm-hmm. for a house. And they were very clear. We allowed her to just do her and find herself. And she mm-hmm. found herself all the way to the Olympics.
To the Olympics. Thank you.
Right?
Thank you so much for saying that, because I feel like I grew up that way where my dad, I am 40 years old. I will be 41 in April. And if I cannot remember a time where if I didn't say to my dad or my mom, I think I want to go to the moon. I truly believe my dad would have came home with moon boots and said, mm-hmm. let's figure out how to get there.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly.
Want to go. And yep. I think I took that into raising my children. And I'm glad that I have a husband who is, because it's not, like you said, it's not always easy. So when I lost my job, you know, we don't live, you know how New York works. They have the subway, they have this, but I live in Maryland. So getting to New York 7-8 days in a row, it's
right.
not the easiest,
no.
Thing to do. But I thank goodness that, you know, I thank God that I have family who are so supportive. Like somebody will say, you know what, take this $100 just in case you need to go to New York. And it's like, wow. And I tell my kids, they believe in you that much.
Right. That, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
We're not going to let fear stop us. And another thing, when you mentioned how you keep going, even if you have fear or apprehension, I was at the gym on Saturday and I had to take a screenshot of this magazine, and a lady, her name is Amy, and I think it's pronounced Engerbretson. And this was so good, because people are, whether they're spiritual, whether they're religious, people automatically assume that you shouldn't have fear. Like, again, we don't have these natural emotions. And she made the statement, fear can be paralyzing to a lot of people. It's not about overcoming it. It's about moving forward through it.
Uh-huh.
And I love that, because fear is it. We can't say fear is not a real emotion. It is
a real emotion. Absolutely. You have to acknowledge it. I mean, that's one thing. I look to Buddhism as a philosophy for a lot of things. And one of the things, but I'm not a Buddhist because I don't know nearly as much about it, but I do know some philosophies. And one of the things that they say is that you have to acknowledge what you're feeling and you have to investigate it. So I'm really good at that now. So if I'm feeling afraid, then I sit and say, okay, I'm feeling afraid. Why am I feeling afraid? And I might even write out, these are the reasons why I'm feeling afraid. By the time I finish that list, I'm like, okay, well, I don't need to be afraid of that, because that doesn't matter yet. Or, you know, I can go back and kind of investigate what I'm feeling.
Right.
And that's basically what she said, is that you can't ignore it. You have to acknowledge what you're feeling. You don't have to wallow in it, but you have
right.
to acknowledge it.
Acknowledge it and go
yeah.
through it. And that's what I'm trying to tell my kids. I said, because sometimes I find that and I think that churches are guilty of it. You know, we're giving this narrative that because you believe in God, nothing's ever going to happen, or you shouldn't,
right.
and you shouldn't have these emotions. And that's
funny.
Just not the case.
Absolutely. Because one of my things that I realized after my mom died, and that's where I kind of looked at Buddhism, because Buddhism talks a lot about suffering and what causes you suffering. And basically, you're in control of your suffering. You know, it's the way you look at things. You don't have to suffer, you know, because someone dies, you don't have to suffer. It's one of those things where I realized, I think a couple of years ago, I finally realized what it meant to be grateful, because I realized, I think I was on a walk and I was like, oh, I get it. because it didn't have to be. You didn't have to get that new job. You didn't have to have that house. You didn't have to have, you know, more time with your parent who's dying. You didn't have, that's why you're grateful. Because grateful for me before was very, like, it was just kind of like, just people say it, you know, like, oh yeah, I'm grateful that, like, it just felt more like, and again, we're only grateful when good things happen.
That's what I was going to say.
You know what I mean?
The after is works.
Yeah. So, because I found myself being, I'm like, well, what do I have to be grateful for when, you know, I no longer have a mother on this earth, or, you know, like things like that. And then I realized, I'm like, oh no, you're grateful because it didn't have to be, like, things didn't have to be. I get it.
That
so,
is
yeah.
So goodness. Again, I'm telling you, you drop a lot of nuggets in your, you're going to have to look now, kid, you're going to have to open it up. So, students that aren't in Florida, we can just Skype and just sit in your class by computer.
I'm telling you, right?
Well, I was watching, and I am guilty of it, and I admit it. And my husband always laughs, and I use it. Of course, it's an excuse, but I say, of course, I'm a reality showologist. Who's going to pray for the craziness? I always tell them if I don't watch it. No, but I was watching The Real Housewives of Dallas, and it was hilarious because they had this big, beautiful event. One of the ladies couldn't attend, and now they have this thing, and it literally looked like an iPad that was on a stick that was attached to a rolling board, or think about a clothing steamer that rolls.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yes.
Yep.
And she literally zoomed into the party. So yeah. If you can make that happen, then my kids can attend.
Yeah, exactly. It's so true.
Yes, but you have I want to thank you, and because I know that you are one thing I can honestly say, my experience with you, because I was introduced to you in October, that you've made time for us, for my family, and you definitely make your word is definitely your bond. You've never just said, oh, I'm going to meet, I'm going to Skype in here, I'm going to call in here. And even with this interview, you were busy all day, and just when you can be relaxing, you agreed to do this interview with me. So I just want you to know how much I appreciate that.
Thank
definitely
you.
And your wisdom, because you have definitely dropped so much knowledge. So I always, my husband, we'll put the podcast together, and then I will go back and listen to it as if I'm a first time
listener.
And I try to listen without critiquing, you know, like myself, but I'm going to have to take notes, because, and I just love what you say. I'm grateful because it didn't have to be. I'm definitely like, that is anytime I think, I lost my grandmother last year, and I was watching, don't judge, Kia, don't judge, another Real Housewives, but it was the Real Housewives of Atlanta, and the mother was turning, one of the mothers was turning 70-something, and I sent a text message to my husband, and I said, I know that life isn't fair, but my grandma, like, it just, she was healthy, 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 boom, a very fast decline, like a year and a half. And I said, here you have this woman on TV, you know, that could have been my grandmother, and he said he didn't know his grandmother. So be grateful that I knew mine. So in that sense, it didn't have to be. So I appreciate it.
Exactly.
You need to put that on a t-shirt, and then people will say, what does that mean? And then they have to come to you to get the explanation.
Yeah, so true. So true.
It didn't have to be. Like, I love that. I love
that. Yeah, I'm telling you that. I got to the point, I'm like, that's what it is. That's why I'm grateful. Because I was starting to be annoyed with just being grateful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like, whoa, why?
Right. That is so true. Like, I'm annoyed with that. That is so true.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm not going to take up any much more of your time on the podcast, but best believe I'm going to be contacting you. Cause I was like, serious, Kia. I'm like, I think I could probably use some lessons. It could help with the podcast. Look, I'm trying to take it away from the children. Like, no, it's my turn. I want a lesson.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. So again, you've been given a gift, and you just want to make sure that you continue to cultivate it, you know?
Yes.
So that's why you read everything. That's why you update your equipment, but you, everyone needs to work on something. So yeah, definitely. I'm here whenever you're ready.
Okay. And you do improv too. That's what I really want my kids to do. I would like,
well, I think you're a really good listener, so I think you won't have a problem with that, because I definitely get the sense that you're a really good listener.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's the biggest part. And, you know, just being present is the biggest obstacle with improv and not being so focused on what you want to say and do. So,
you know what? Do you hear that, listeners? Husband, mom, you know, because dad, I am a good listener. Teacher from the fifth grade who said I didn't listen. I just want to thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
And I want you, if you could, give your and I never let you hear your title. So your title is Kia Riddick Taylor, from casting to coaching. This star catcher fills us in on what happens when real life becomes unscripted. So that was your, so if you could give your, the name of your school, give out all of your sites that way, if, because I know people ask me a lot about the industry and getting in the industry. Mm-hmm. And one thing you did say to me after you, when you and I were talking after my daughter had her lesson was, you're very honest with parents.
Yes.
You don't, you're not just taking someone's money. If they don't, if the child doesn't want to do it, you can sense that.
So, yeah, so, absolutely.
So that's one
absolutely.
Thing. So if you can give all of your, any ways to contact you.
Yes. So my website is www.starcatcheractingstudio.com. It's all one word. And my Instagram is the same, Starcatcher Acting Studio. And my Twitter is @Starcatcher_FL.
Okay.
So and you can reach me on any of those things.
Okay, and I will definitely be putting those in the description.
And Facebook as well. Facebook is StarcatcherActingStudio.com too. Starcatcher Acting Studio, yeah.
Okay.
So the only one that's different is Instagram, because the name's too long for Insta.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, because they do have that. Because I wanted to do Tales from a Butterfly, and I said, that's not going to work. So
yep,
I just did my initials, yep. Okay,
yep.
Well, Kia, thank you so much. I will be contacting you after. And please tell your husband, thank you for letting me have you for an hour and 20 minutes of your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in to episode 48 of the Tales from a Butterfly podcast. I truly, truly hope that you got something out of it, some lessons. I especially loved what she said about being grateful, because sometimes we're only grateful when the outcome is what we want it to be. But we have to be grateful because the outcome or the time that we had before the outcome didn't have to be. So I totally, totally hope that you guys got something out of this lesson. I know I definitely did. Can you believe we're on episode 48? I'm going to announce every single number like that. And then when I get to 100, I'm not even going to tell y'all what I'm getting ready to do. But I'm just so grateful and thankful, butterflies, that we're hanging out and we're doing this thing together and that we are partners in this. So since we're partners, please go and subscribe and rate the podcast by clicking on the fifth star. I promise it takes less than 2 minutes. And if you're feeling generous, you can leave a comment that says, great, awesome, liked it. You can only leave really, really, really good ones. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm joking, but I'm serious. Now, you can do this by either going to iTunes, Blueberry, BlueBrry, Stitcher, and Google Play Music, and typing in Tales from a Butterfly. The more ratings I get, the more visible the podcast, which in turn will bring in more sponsors. And that's really important, guys. It helps keeps podcasting free and it helps your girl out big time. Also, you can head on over to TariaShondell.com, T as in Tom, AriaShondell.com, to follow my blog by the same name, Tales from a Butterfly. Hopefully I'll be updating that soon with a new blog for you guys. But you're more than welcome to check out some of my older blog posts while you're over there. Also, FYI, if you don't have iTunes, as I mentioned earlier, you can listen in on blueberry.com. That's BlueBrry.com. Now, if you go to blueberry.com, you'll type in Tales from a Butterfly. When the Tales from a Butterfly directory pops up, click on the episode you want to listen to, and right there in a little box right on the episode, you'll be given options to subscribe to the podcast. You can do it by iTunes, Android, or email. And please, please, please share the episodes on your different social medias. Share it with your family, your friends, your coworkers. I mean, sharing is really caring, guys. It really is. Y'all know that. We learned that when we were little. And speaking of social media, you can follow me on Twitter @TSFazond, on Instagram at T.S. Faison and on Facebook at Tales from a Butterfly. And guys, remember, no matter what it is you go through this week, no matter what situation that you find yourself in that you feel like fear has gotten a hold of you and you just can't get over it, don't worry. You don't necessarily have to get over the fear. You just got to take a deep breath and keep moving through the fear. And I guarantee you'll come out of it on the other side. Love you guys. Thanks for listening.